Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are a few people whose insights, whose intelligence I value more on these matters than our first guests, and those are the insights of Kevin Freeman, one of the country's preeminent experts on economic warfare. He is a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, the driving force behind globaleconomicwarfare.com. He is also the author of two best-selling books, Game Plan and Secret Weapon. And not least, he is the star of a new television production appearing on CRTV's network, Mark Levin's fabulous new offering, called Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Kevin, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank.
You know, there's so much to talk with you about, Kevin. I'm struck by, obviously, the moment we find ourselves in. The election of 2018 is upon us, less than 8 days away now. It is shaping up to be a national election in a way that I don't remember from previous midterms. At least it's not all that common in my experience. Talk a little bit about specifically the proposition that Donald Trump has put out, that essentially this is not simply a mandate for him, but a question of the direction in which the country is going to head, one that he has defined through, among other terms, as nationalism versus something very different. And what are the economic sort of repercussions of this important choice?
Well, Frank, there's no doubt that this is the most important midterm election that I can remember. We are faced with the idea, are we going to continue on the track that President Trump put us on, which is a more national track. It's a Make America Great Again is his theme, or the historic track that we'd been on under the Obama administration and really under the Bush administration to a certain degree as well. And that's a globalist track where we're citizens of the world and not an independent nation. And that goes to the issue of whether the borders are open or closed. It goes to the issue of trade policy. It goes to the issue of all sorts of economic realities of people's lives. So the question is, it's not a matter so much if when you vote for a congressperson, are you voting for the person you like best or worst? You're actually voting for the leadership and the direction of the country that would accompany that. And so you need to look at the Democrat leaders and the Republican leaders and say, which one best casts my vision? And the globalist approach is more progressive. It includes a number of people who are pro-socialism, openly pro-socialism. It includes a number of people openly pro-open borders.
And again, you've touched on sort of the economic implications of this, but Kevin, for most of this century, this young century of ours, we have been encouraged to believe that if we only focus on sort of open markets and engage in transactions with people, even people who may actually have interests very much at odds with our own, that all will be well. We'll make money and we'll see them prosper and that will make them more benign. I'm thinking specifically, of course, of communist China. That's a choice that has sort of been taken for granted for many years. And yet Donald Trump has kind of framed up an alternative to it that arguably is on the ballot this year, too.
Well, we long said what we see as a marketplace or enemies view as a battle space. And I don't say that lightly. I say that because I've studied the the doctrines and the texts of Communist China, for example, through the book Unrestricted Warfare, but also historically through the Soviet Union, the KGB. Other nations tend to see trade policy as a game of winning and losing. We would love if the world would embrace global free trade. I believe very firmly in global free trade, but when you have one party or multiple parties that not only cheat, but they rig the game in their favor, you end up losing and you lose free trade in the end. In the end, it destroys a free market economy. It doesn't enhance it to blindly go along.
This brings me to China. There's an article that appeared the other day, Kevin Freeman, that I wanted to get your reaction to. It was on CNN by a fellow by the name of David Andelman, to the effect that China may simply wait out Donald Trump rather than try to deal with him. The Chinese have, of course, been arguably the biggest beneficiary of this globalist mindset, this idea that trade uber alles, if you will make the world a better place, more secure for the United States, among others. Do you anticipate that the Chinese are going to simply wait and let nature take its course on Donald Trump, or are they actively engaged in trying to influence the choice we make and undermine him?
There is no way that China will sit back and say, we'll wait it out and see how things are going. They are already active with technology, with Facebook, with every other opportunity that they can. If we believe that the Russians interfered in our election in 2016, then we have to believe that China is active right now with every means of power at their disposal. They have far more riding on this than Russia did 2 years ago, and it fits the doctrine of unrestricted warfare. So I'm certain that they are using whatever techniques that they can, including attempts to manipulate the American electorate, period.
Yeah, influence the electorate, and again, undermine Donald Trump. Kevin, as you look at that influence operation, one of the plays that they seem to have been making was to try to affect the constituency that Donald Trump and his allies in Congress would typically have, notably in the agricultural sector around the United States, and some involved in trading with China, non-agricultural products. Is that working as you see it right now? Are they actually having the desired effect in diminishing support for the president and his program in those sort of core constituencies?
Well, there's no doubt that they've targeted and micro-targeted down to the congressional district on trade policy. They've examined, for example, what would this trade policy do to this, you know, District 4 in this state where there's a presidential supporter supporter there, and they've done it with soybeans and so forth. The purpose of this is to achieve their long-term objective. They want to be the dominant economic player, not only in Asia, but in the world.
We've been seeing some pretty strong perturbations in that force in recent days, as you know better than anybody. Kevin Freeman, a chartered financial analyst, among other things, as well as the driving force behind a superb new program, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. And Kevin, tell people how they can find it again.
Okay, go to economicwarroom.com.
Perfect. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us. Next up, we'll speak a bit more about China with our duty expert on the subject, Gordon Chang. We're told war with China may be inevitable. What do you think? Find out more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom. With Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being just about every week by one of my favorite people, Gordon Chang, a man who has established himself as one of the really go-to resources for those of us reporting on and trying to make sense of these times as they relate to changes taking place in Asia, most especially with Communist China and what they might mean for our security. And Gordon Chang, I value so much our conversations. I value so much your two terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, as well as your writings at places like The Daily Beast and National Interest. But never more than at the moment when there is talk from a number of different quarters about the likelihood that we will find ourselves at war with Communist China in the not-too-distant future. I understand you had an opportunity to spend some time talking to a retired lieutenant general by the name of Hodges, who has been quoted by Military Times as saying that he thinks it's likely the United States will be at war in 15 years with the Chinese. Tell us what you took away from your conversations with General Hodges.
The most important thing, I think, is that General Hodges is concerned that the United States is not prepared for conflict. He was the commander of the U.S. Army in Europe until about last year, and he actually talked about the U.S. force structure in Europe, because he's mentioned that, for instance, our troops went from 300,000 to 30,000, and the last tank went home 6 years ago. He's concerned about the possibility of not being able to defend Europe if there is conflict in East Asia, obviously China. And so this is a two-front war. We talked about having the U.S. once having this posture of being able to fight two and a half wars simultaneously. That went to one and a half wars. Now we're down to about one. We're very stretched right now, he pointed out. We've got troops, of course, in Afghanistan and Iraq, and also we defend sea lanes. At the same time, we've got Russia and China threatening their neighborhoods. And so he was concerned that we are in a period of vulnerability. This coincides, Frank, with what people have been talking about as the decade of concern with regard to China, which is the 2020s. Where China is moving in certain directions, which are extremely dangerous, and the United States has yet to comprehend and fully respond.
I wonder about that decade, Gordon, because at the end of that decade, of course, is a period where the Chinese have, I believe, set their sights on being the dominant world power, or certainly a very formidable military power. So this decade is perhaps the period in which we have an opportunity to prevent that, hopefully not through the use of force, but through our own build-up and projection of capabilities into East Asia and elsewhere. And as you look at this, Gordon, of course, we have to take into account some of the things that the Chinese are saying themselves about their intentions. And I understand that China's President Xi Jinping is actually talking about preparing for war against the United States, specifically in the South China Sea and in the region around Taiwan. Talk about that.
Yes, those comments were made to the senior officers of the Southern Theater Command, which has responsibility for Taiwan and the South China Sea, both of which he mentioned. Xi Jinping has talked about this, about being prepared for war on a number of occasions, so this is not the first time. But nonetheless, it does coincide with a number of troubling developments, and clearly is part of a larger trend where Xi Jinping is talking more than just being generally prepared to defend your territory. He's actually talking about, I think, offensive war, because nobody's threatening China, Frank. So when he mentions these words, especially in this context, it's got to be in the point of, look, we're going to take territory from our neighbors. Got to remember that this coincides with the Chinese defense minister mentioning, talking in similar terms at a defense forum in Beijing. So we're hearing a drumbeat of very aggressive words from Chinese leaders and military officers.
Yeah, I did want to talk to you a bit about the comments of the defense minister, Wei Fengji, about, I guess, in particular, the comments Mike Pence, the vice president of the United States, made recently at the Hudson Institute that were very critical of what the Chinese are up to, and claiming that the Chinese are concerned that Vice President Pence and others like him are, quote, seriously damaging the Sino-U.S. relationship and mutual trust, unquote. Now, Gordon, few people monitor what the Chinese are up to more closely than you do. To what extent is this a case of, as I think the Bard put it, them protesting too much, because what they are in fact doing on the ground, in the air, at sea, and around the world increasingly, is damaging any basis for Sino-U.S. relations, and let alone mutual trust?
Well, the United States is reacting to obvious Chinese provocations, belligerence, and, as we talked about, aggressive words. And Vice President Pence's comments October 4th at the Hudson Institute were important because it shows that the United States is starting to think seriously about China's destabilizing conduct. And the most important thing, Frank, and I think in the Chinese minds, is not how many ships that we have in the South China Sea or whatever. I think it's their belief in our political will. And if they believe we don't have political will, they will tend to be aggressive. When they understand that the United States will defend the interests of itself and its allies and the international community, then the Chinese sort of slink back. So this is a two-front issue. It's not only the number of platforms we have, which of course is critical, but it's also their measurement of what we are willing to do to protect ourselves. So therefore, Vice President Pence's speech was an important rhetorical pivot, and I'm glad that he made it.
It is, and hopefully, again, as you say, Gordon, it is backed up by action. Rhetoric alone does not suffice. The Chinese are very famous for perceiving what they call paper tigers as nothing more than, you know, empty rhetoric. Gordon, let me turn to another country that, of course, has a very prominent role both in Europe and in Asia, a threat to our forces and allies in both places, and that is Vladimir Putin's Russia. We've talked in the past about the president's decision to withdraw from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty that I had a small hand in negotiating but found defective in the end. And it seems to me entirely appropriate that given Russian violations of this treaty and the fact that it doesn't protect us or our forces or our allies or our interests from threats unconstrained by it from the Chinese, that we are well advised to be pulling out of it and taking appropriate countermeasures in both respects. To say nothing of the North Koreans and the Iranians and others who have these intermediate range forces. Vladimir Putin has reportedly responded to this by declaring that this is going to lead to war with the United States. What can you say about that? There's a lot of this war talk at the moment, it seems. How serious a threat should we regard that to be?
Well, I think that withdrawal from the INF Treaty was the right thing to do and actually reduces the risk of war. There are two problems with the treaty, both of which you mentioned. One of them is that the Russians have been violating it for at least a decade, and the United States was not taking effective action to bring Russia back into compliance. And the second thing is the Chinese are just not part of INF, which means that they are unconstrained, as you say, to build intermediate-range missiles. What pulling out of the INF will do is it'll allow us to develop counter weapons, and that's important. And of course, as you say, the Iranians and the North Koreans were not part of it either. But it's really the Chinese not being a treaty partner is really, I think, the biggest fault with INF these days. INF was negotiated at a time when you could argue that there was a bilateral structure in the international system. That's no longer true. China is arming up very fast, and we've got to meet that challenge. And so I think that the United States withdrawal actually reduces the risk of war, not only in Europe, but also in Asia.
From your lips to God's ears. Gordon, one last question. We haven't talked in a couple of weeks about North Korea, and that's not because there aren't things happening there that are important. It's just there have been a lot of other things going on, too. I saw an article to the effect that something on the order of 100 tons of items that are supposed to be subject to U.S. Sanctions, and for that matter, I guess, global sanctions, have nonetheless been exported to North Korea by the South Korean government of Moon Jae-in. Tell us what's going on there and what the implications of that may be.
Chosin Ilbo, the Seoul newspaper, reported that South Korea during 2018 has exported 100 tons of equipment that is under UN sanctions. And what this is highlighting is that the government of Moon Jae-in has been deliberately violating the UN rules. This is something that the United States has not dealt with. You know, we haven't dealt with the Chinese and the Russians violating sanctions openly, and we haven't gotten around to the South Koreans. The United States needs to do something. If we don't, the situation in the peninsula is going to rapidly deteriorate, especially because Moon Jae-in is so pro-North Korea. We have not dealt with this, Frank. The treaty, our alliance arrangement with South Korea could easily fall apart because it's now becoming untenable for us. And so this is an action that the president, our president, needs to take immediately.
I couldn't agree more. Gordon, thank you for your time today. Many sobering topics and more to come, I'm quite sure. Indeed, we'll be talking more about North Korea in a moment with our friend Claudia Rosette. Straight ahead.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Claudia Rosette, one of the country's preeminent writers and journalists and investigative reporters, editorialists, an accomplished and indeed award-winning essayist and most especially forensic analyst of criminal and other wrongdoings at places like the United Nations. Indeed, she's won the Eric Brandel Award for her reporting on the so-called Oil for Food program in Iraq, and the Overseas Press Club Citation for Excellence for her writing about China's Tiananmen Square suppression of a fledgling democratic movement there. She has posted with the Wall Street Journal in places like Hong Kong and in Russia and, of course, in New York City. She is a remarkable friend and much admired contributor through her writings at PJ Media's Rosette Report and her work as a senior fellow with the Independent Women's Forum. Claudia Rosette, it's so good to have you back. Welcome.
Frank, thank you for that introduction.
Well, heartfelt and all true. It's better yet. Listen, Claudia, you have been publicly commenting a bit on this so-called Khashoggi affair. He, of course, met a bad fate, it appears, in the Saudi consulate, Jamal Khashoggi did. What should we think about what's happened here? And most especially, what, if anything, should be done in response?
Okay. What should we think? That it's horrendous when anyone is murdered inside a consulate or in various other locations and in, you know, in many ways. But this should not become the event that now shapes American policy in the Middle East. It's just the fact is there are far bigger things in play and many more lives at stake on many other fronts. And the way that this has been playing out, it's very hard in a lot of the media coverage in the U.S. to figure out what's really been going on because it's a drama basically with no heroes, as Karen Elliott House wrote in the Wall Street Journal a little while back. It's not actually a case, you know, Jamal Khashoggi was not a reporter who was sort of inquiring independently into what was going on in the Middle East. He was a player in Saudi politics. That doesn't in any way justify the murdering of his murder, but it does tell us that there's more at work here and you really need to look more at what's behind the scenes, the context, and so on.
Yeah. Among other things, it appears, in addition to being a critic of his own government, he was associated with Osama bin Laden. He was a Muslim Brotherhood operative. He, by some accounts, was a Saudi intelligence player as well. All of these things gum up the storyline that he was just a journalist who was, taken out because of his criticisms of the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. But more to the point, Claudia, I guess the question is, as we talked about with Danny, if we follow the guidance that we're getting from Lindsey Graham, let's say, and others on Capitol Hill and in the media, that, you know, we must punish Saudi Arabia very strongly for this, I worry that we wind up, unless other things are done, rewarding countries that are much more problematic from our point of view. And I've been no fan of the Saudis over the years. I think neither have you, for a lot of what they've done, particularly in promoting Sharia supremacism, as I call it. But talk a little bit about, you know, what we should be thinking and doing with respect to the Turks, the Qataris, the Iranians, and the Muslim Brotherhood.
That's the problem, Frank. You know, the phrase that keeps coming to mind over and over is pick your poison. We're not talking about a region of the world where there's sort of an array of benign democracies on display to where you can choose your friends. In fact, as Neil Ferguson wrote, if we're going to limit our sort of friendly dealings in the Middle East only to liberal democracies, that pretty much leaves you with the Israelis, and that's it. Israel's the only one. And the problem with now saying, okay, we're just going to cut loose Saudi Arabia, we want nothing more to do with them, we're going to shun them, sanction them, and so on, is this is a gift to Iran. Iran is a serious military threat in the region, has been pursuing for a long time nuclear weapons, whatever the narratives put out under the Obama administration, that's the truth of it. And we're just short of a new round of sanctions on Iran, with which the Trump administration is trying to contain them. And here's where it starts to get quite complicated. One of the countries that has been a major help to Iran in the past in evading sanctions is Turkey. So we now have suddenly this story has erupted, and Turkey has been sort of leaking this out bit by bit to just keep it rolling in the press. With the calls for the U.S. to cut loose the Saudis, this is a gift to Iran. And Iran is a threat around the world with its terrorist mascots, with Hezbollah, with Hamas, with its sort of footholds in Latin America. So the problem is, how do you maneuver through this? And certainly something needs to be done, said, to say to the Saudis, no, America does not want this going on. You want to do business with us. You can't be murdering people in your consulates and lying about it. But there must be ways that we can punish them. And some of that's already been happening. You know, they've gotten a lot of very bad publicity from this.
Davos in the desert was mostly desert, it seems, among other things.
Again, it shouldn't shape our policy in the Middle East. That could be disastrous.
One of the other things that I've been touting, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on it, is that we ought to make it clear that there are costs to others as well if we're going to be punishing one side so as to ensure that the other doesn't benefit to our detriment. And one of my pet rocks is getting the Muslim Brotherhood designated as the terrorist organization that it is. I think this would send a very profound signal to the region, as we are hopefully also sending to the Saudis, that in addition to the sanctions on some of the malefactors here, we want you to stop what you're doing in our country to promote, you know, Sharia supremacism. These would be opportunities to do something really useful in the moment that we're trying to figure out how to appropriately respond to this crime.
This is where, in the descriptions of Jamal Khashoggi as a reporter or as a sort of ardent defender of free speech, I've been struck that people have not been paying attention to other Washington Post columns that he wrote, including one, at least, that I've read, advocating in favor of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is not at all a force for free speech. So again, that is in no way, nothing justifies his murder. He shouldn't have been murdered for this, but neither is it accurate to say he was simply a champion of free speech. That's not true either. So again, we need to understand the complexities.
Speaking of complexities and the importance of getting clear who's on our side and who is not, let's pivot to the subject of a piece that you wrote in the Dallas Morning News the other day about North Korea You followed these guys very closely for a long time, particularly when you were out in the Hong Kong Bureau of the Wall Street Journal on the editorial board page portfolio there. Talk a little bit about what's going on as you see it in terms of the Trump program vis-a-vis Kim Jong-un of North Korea, and what should it be?
Okay, Frank, I've thought for a long time and still think that the only real solution to North Korea is an end to the regime. That's something that John Bolton has basically argued as well before he became National Security Advisor, that the problem is the regime. And this totalitarian, malign regime that's been in power since Stalin installed Kim Jong-un's grandfather after World War II. And the fact that that's very difficult to get to, it's risky, it's high cost. We don't want another Korean War. We don't want to reignite it. It never officially came to an end, doesn't change the fact that it's probably true, that that really is what's required. And no president has wanted to risk it. And the argument I made in this article is that is the glaring fact that people don't, I think it's a fact, that people, my opinion is that this is the case, that people don't want to address because there's no appetite in this country to go to war over Korea. And when President Trump came in, he basically had to do triage. There was quite a crisis building. North Korea was had conducted 4 nuclear tests, 5, making a total of 5. 1 on President Bush's watch, 4 on President Obama's watch. And but when Trump arrived in office, within months, North Korea was successfully testing intercontinental ballistic missiles. And then last September, what was apparently a hydrogen bomb. Something had to be done. And then the question becomes what? What President Trump did was he made a lot of threats. He tried to sort of choke off the cash flows, add more sanctions, cut Kim down to size, little rocket man, and so on. And then and now comes this year where we have this deal. I don't think there's any deal. No, it doesn't matter what the details are, that's going to persuade Kim Jong-un to voluntarily give up his nuclear kit. So to me, the real question is there anything in the way that we're handling this that suggests we're heading for a moment when we bring down the North Korean regime or nudge it toward collapse? And there are a few faint signs, but really it's very hard to tell what the real game is behind Mike Pompeo, behind Secretary of State Pompeo's that sort of tight smile where he keeps going to Pyongyang, meeting with officials, including Kim Jong-un, and comes back to report, you know, well, we're working on it. What I hope is that behind the scenes, we're threatening the life out of Kim Jong-un, but I don't think we know that.
We don't know it, but it's what we should be doing. I couldn't agree with you more. Claudia Rosette, as always, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you joining us from time to time, and hope you'll do it again soon.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It is a delight to say we are joined by an old friend, George Raceley. He served his country in a number of capacities, including as a member of the senior staff of then Vice President of the United States, Dan Quayle, in the George H.W. Bush administration. These days, he is the editor of a terrific online resource, Conservative HQ. You can follow his writings at conservativehq.com. I'm always fond of saying, as a way of further enhancing the value of his comments, which we'll have in a moment, that he is a pedigreed genius, a member of the Mensa Society. We're always delighted to have him. You claim that I only say that because your mom put me up to it. It's not true, George. It's coming from a place of genuine admiration by me. So welcome back.
Well, thank you, thank you, thank you.
So, George, you have been writing for some time now about this set of pipe bombs, as we're told they're to be characterized as, aimed at a number of prominent Democrats who have been critical of President Trump since the arrest on Friday of a fellow charged with sending those so-called explosive devices. I say so-called because I'm told that they may have had nothing more than firecracker powder in them and really nothing to cause them to detonate. But when you look at what we've learned about this alleged perpetrator, what is your assessment of the nature of this crime and the seriousness of it in point of fact?
Well, I'm coming at this from the perspective of an old newspaper, old-time newspaper guy. I got my first newspaper byline in 1976, and when my mother retired, it was the first time in 150 years no one in our family been in the newspaper business. And so, you know, I'm extremely skeptical of the obvious, shall we say. And of course, the obvious result of this is to, because this guy is claimed as a rabid supporter of Donald Trump, is to dirty up the president and his agenda right before the midterm elections, and to dishearten Republican and conservative voters. And whenever there's a crime with a political aspect to it, my skepticism of the obvious comes right to the fore. And you would start looking at this guy. He is the most unlikely terrorist you can imagine. Unless overuse of steroids turns you into a right winger, in which case there would probably be no kneeling in the NFL.
George, let me just ask you about that, because there is photographic evidence of this chap, and his name, by the way, is Cesar Sayoc, in a MAGA hat, a Make America Great Again hat, holding up a sign. I think it's at a Trump rally, to the effect of CNN sucks. When you look at his record, though, it seems as though he was at least as enamored until relatively recently of the left as he ever was of Donald Trump. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in fact, there's a fairly recent photograph of him with a big grin on his face giving a hug to a major Florida Democrat. You know, the evidence, his political affiliation is at best mixed. The media has reported him as being a registered Republican, but he is also a convicted felon, meaning in Florida that he could not register to vote. And that on its face is something that, you know, needs to be further investigated. But no one in the establishment media has chosen to do that. It's just, you know, okay, he's a Republican.
Right. Pass it on, as they say. And George, in addition to the fact that these devices seemingly couldn't have done much, if any, harm to anybody, even though the FBI was treating them as, apparently potentially dangerous, as best I can tell, none of them was actually going to be received by the addressee. That is to say, they were going to go to screening facilities manned by the Secret Service or other security details, that they were going to mail rooms at CNN and the like. So to the extent that actual harm was intended, it seems as though this was not much of a vehicle for accomplishing it. Am I missing something there?
You know, without making light of, what was a serious crime, it looks like the serious crime was intended to get George Soros's butler or the mail clerk at CNN, not the
Soros and John Brennan, respectively.
Yeah, they're all going to either the wrong place or a place where the mail would be screened. And so if it's a terrorist plot, it's an odd combination of excellent planning and astonishingly bad intelligence.
It raises questions about the intent. George, and again, neither of us is in any way trying to trivialize this problem or the impetus behind it. But I think what we're trying to address is legitimate questions that have to be examined rather than just sort of accepting at face value what we've been told about Mr. Soyuk and his caper. What I also just want to tease out with you, because it speaks to, you know, your instincts as a former journalist back in the day when that was a notable and worthy profession, about who benefits from all of this. And again, it's not to excuse or assign blame to anybody other than the individual that we're told is responsible, but it does seem to me, in this highly charged political environment and at this endgame moment in a hugely important election, that the fact that a number of people who were directly involved in promoting, at the very minimum, widespread political disturbances, if not actual violence, have suddenly been transformed by having been one of the intended recipients of these so-called pipe bombs into victims of such violence, changing rather dramatically a lot of the narratives. Again, tease this out for us as to what you make of it and what we, in turn, should make of it.
Well, it's a classic Alinskyite tactic. Make yourself a victim. And it, of course, excuses in the narrative being promoted by the left-wing media, pardon me for repeating myself there, that the individuals who are critical of Trump are now, instead of inciters of violence, they're the victims of violence. And you go right through the list. And, you know, everyone from Hillary Clinton and her "we can't be civil until we win," Maxine Waters, call a crowd and, you know, run people out of restaurants and gas stations. You go right down the line, and practically every one of the targets of Soyuk's alleged pipe bombs were inciters of violence. But now they're victims. And again, this is a classic Alinskyite tactic. It begs the question of, you know, how did he come up with this list? Why now? And, you know, how did a guy who's allegedly living out of his van put all this together? And none of that is being pursued by the establishment media, because answers to those questions wouldn't fit the narrative that, you know, Trump is the bad guy and the real source of violence in America, when in fact it's the left that has consistently been calling for violence.
It has, and it continues to do so, as best I can tell, which is all the more worrying. George Raceley, we have to leave it at that. There is so much more to talk with you about. I hope we'll have a chance to do so in the days ahead. We'll talk with you again soon, and we'll talk, I hope, with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, thank you for listening. This is Frank Gaffney, over and out.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.